He was never taught to keep his opinions to himself. That's why we love him. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Very disappointed to not be on the air at 420 this year. I had something special planned for the show. We're going to be joined by Afro Man in studio. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. 420, we had Snoop Dogg coming in to host Baseball Central with me. That's true. Would have been great. Anyhow, so ahead of time, happy 420. So Masahiro Tanaka looked pretty good. Now, okay. Advance warning. It was against the Cubs. So let's throw it out, that out there. I mean, he was pitching against a team that's not very good and not likely to be good for a while. And even when it is good, always figures out a way to screw things up. But having said that, it was a dominant performance, a dominant early season performance. And the American League East has, you know, we've always talked about how it might be the toughest division in baseball. It's kind of turned into, in a lot of ways, early in the season, one of the most interesting divisions in baseball because everybody's hurt. Everybody's got somebody on the DL. Everybody has questions at some pretty significant areas. And nobody, here's the thing, nobody's run away with the American League East. And nobody's fallen out of the American League East. I'm just, call me crazy. Wouldn't be the first time. But if you're the Toronto Blue Jays, you're looking around you right now and you're saying, you know what? This first couple of weeks has pretty much gone just about as well as we could script it. John Paul Morosi is a national baseball writer for Fox Sports. He joins us on the Jeff Blair Show to discuss this and other issues. The American League East is, it's pretty much a dog's breakfast right now, isn't it?
It is very, very compact, Jeff. I think there's a lot of parity in that division. And you're right. If I'm the Jays, I'm very pleased with the way things have unfolded so far. I think that obviously the many pitching injuries of the Tampa Bay Rays, probably the biggest storyline of them all, just because of what Matt Moore certainly being out for the season and Alex Cobb being on the disabled list right now have done to that club in terms of really allowing the other teams to get a head start. I mean, you have the Yankees for all their injuries in the infield with starting Solarte and Dean Anna and Francisco Cervelli on national television there on Sunday night. They're in first place by a half game over the Jays. So I think it's allowed a lot of teams to really stay in it. And I frankly think one storyline I'm really watching going forward, Jeff, is going to be Dustin Pedroia. And I know he had two hits and three runs scored last night. So it was huge for the Red Sox to get him back in the lineup with this injury he's been dealing with. So we'll see if he's able to be in there every day and continue to have that presence at the plate that he had last night, but obviously if he ends up either being out of the lineup for a period of time or not being himself, that is really a game changer for both the Red Sox and the rest of the division. But I agree. Meanwhile, the Jays just have to keep doing basically what they've done, maybe get a little bit more out of R.A. Dickey, but for the most part, it's a pretty good baseball team right now in Toronto.
Yeah, and the pitching injuries to Tampa Bay is something, and look, we've talked about this a lot. A lot of people in baseball have talked about the Rays' ability to not only keep their pitchers healthy, but know when to get rid of guys before their arms explode. I mean, they have a better sense of pitching self than any organization in baseball, although I'm beginning to think Oakland might be pretty close to them. And when I see Rays pitchers going down with a variety of injuries, that to me is a sign that look, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's going to be this close all the way through the season, but I really thought, frankly, coming out of spring training, as I looked at the teams, John, I thought the chances were there that Boston and Tampa could put some space between themselves and the other teams right out of the gate. That has not happened.
I agree, and I think that when you talk about what would have differentiated the Rays from the rest of the division, and certainly why I picked Tampa Bay to win the division, it was their rotation and their starting pitching depth. Now, I like their depth. I still like their depth, but I don't know if I really like their depth all the way with three starting pitchers on the DL, with obviously Hellickson joining Moore and Cobb on the DL. And Cobb was my pick to win the Cy Young. I mean, this guy is a tremendous pitcher. So I think that when you talk about that magnitude of injuries, it really has leveled the entire division. And I think when you look at it right now, Jeff, you would even include the Red Sox in this. I don't think there's a single dominant rotation for any team in this division.
No.
And I think, obviously Tanaka has come in and pitched terrifically well. He's got an ERA just north of 2. Pineda, obviously, Pintar or no Pintar, he's pitching very well for the Yankees. So I think they have to be very pleased, the Yankees do, with what they've gotten from a pitching standpoint. And again, the Jays, that outing McGowan had over the weekend in Baltimore, just sensational. I said at the time, probably one of the most impressive performances we've seen all year, just based on where he has come from and the fact that he was supposed to be a reliever for much of camp. And Hutchinson, obviously, has done a pretty good job. So and Burley, obviously, has been magnificent. So I think every team probably feels somewhat good about three spots in the rotation, maybe even four. But I don't know that anybody's going to sit there and say, you know what, we just have five, we're rolling five, we are in great shape, and we're just going to win this thing right now going away. Nobody feels that way. So I think if there's going to ever be a year to just sort of hang in there and find a way, for me, this might be it. And for the Jays, I think it's got to be Brandon Morrow giving him more innings and Dickey giving him probably more quality innings than what they've had in the past. That's going to be the key thing, because the bullpen has saved them a couple different times, but you can't go to that well too many times, or else you're going to have guys on the disabled list in July and August with arm trouble. So I think the key thing for the Jays that I'm watching now, Jeff, is the innings out of the starting rotation, and if they're able to give the bullpen a little bit of a breather, because we've seen already this year when the bullpen is used in the right situations, it can be a very good bullpen for the Toronto Blue Jays.
John Palmarosi of Fox Sports joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Have we learned anything about Masahiro Tanaka that should surprise us? I mean, that performance yesterday was remarkable in its efficiency, and it was dominating. And again, I kept reminding people it was the Cubs, and you sort of do have to throw that caveat out there. But have you seen something from Masahiro Tanaka that surprises you, that suggests that maybe his his pedigree exceeds his reputation?
Well, two things. I think number one, we're seeing so far 28 strikeouts in 22 innings over three starts. That's obviously way more than one strikeout per inning, which is pretty impressive for a guy that really, by reputation, was not regarded as a huge strikeout power guy. This mm-hmm. is not Yu Darvish. This is more of a Hiroki Kuroda type, his teammate in New York. That's more of the close comparable, but he's striking guys out left and right. And so I think on this end of things, Jeff, you look at it and say, okay, well, he's come in certainly striking out more guys than we thought, so maybe he's got a little bit better in the power stuff category than we expected. That being said, this is his first time through the league, and so we'll see how hitters adjust him in the second half. But for me, really, when you talk about the initial rollout of Masahiro Tanaka's career, it's been more impressive than what Darvish did in 2012. Remember, Darvish had that rocky first start against
right.
the Mariners, and Tanaka has had none of those, whether it's nerves, adjustment, whatever you want to call it. He has gone into the American League East in a fairly difficult ballpark to pitch in and has just been terrific. So this has got to be a huge, great sign for the Yankees right now. And Solarte, obviously, in the infield has really done well. He's hitting around 400. So the Yankees have had a couple, you couldn't really call Tanaka a surprise, but they've had a couple very good developments early in the season that maybe people didn't expect. And right now, that's why they're in first place in the American League East.
Yeah, he held the Cubs to a pair of bunt singles. He struck out 10 in 8 innings. The Yankees won 3-0. His 28 strikeouts through the three starts, according to the Elias Sports Bureau, breaks a club record that Al Leiter held, 25 through his first three in 1987. I mean, this is, you're right. This is a, it's, you always wait until you see a guy around the second time through before you really make a judgment on him. But I think, if nothing else, the fact that he's striking out so many people the first time through speaks to the quality of his stuff and just to the movement on his pitches more than anything else.
No question. And obviously he has excellent secondary stuff. And I think we're seeing more and more, Jeff. If obviously he's got enough fastball to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to throw 99, but he's got plenty of fastball. And I think that when we talk about what makes pitchers special now. It's the ability to really command the fastball, and then obviously it's to have a good repertoire of off-speed stuff that can really keep guys guessing. And when you're commanding two or three different off-speed pitches the way that Tanaka can, plus commanding your fastball, I mean, there's not a whole lot of hitters in the world that are going to be able to catch up to your stuff. So I think we're seeing a guy he's hard right now, and again, we'll see how if hitters adjust in the second half, but he's a hard guy for hitters to keyhole, obviously. He's a hard guy for people to figure out and guess correctly on. And we could talk about whether or not hitters are really, even the elite hitters are guess hitters, so to speak, but they're not really able to figure him out yet in terms of really really determining and guessing in the right fashion which pitches are coming in which counts. He's got enough off-speed pitches, the different types of breaking balls and the split and that kind of thing, that he can really keep guys guessing, and so far it's obviously working out great.
John, the item you have up on the Fox Sports website about Miguel Cabrera is interesting. He's hitting .227. Again, it's 11 games. It's early, but he has told you that he's still suffering a bit from that the sports hernia surgery that he had in October. And I watched a little bit of him a couple of games ago. He is not the same guy.
No, and I think that was an important admission that Miguel made yesterday, just that he's not injured. He didn't use that word. He didn't say he was hurt. But he did acknowledge that he's still working very hard to rebuild his core strength, and he has to do a battery of exercises every day. And that tells me he's not really full strength. He said he's doing so many exercises, Jeff, that he said he's going to go to the beach with a T-shirt on this offseason. So eventually it's going to pay off. But right now, it's really inhibiting his ability to have the type of follow-through that he wants. We talk about the real classic hitter follow-throughs. I think about Ken Griffey Jr., that one-handed follow-through,
yep.
Graceful. And Miguel Cabrera, when he's on posters the last couple of years, following through after home runs, it's a one-hand flourish. And he's not really able to get that full trunk torso rotation through at this point in time. And yesterday that was leaving him susceptible to some pretty, fastballs that are pretty much located over the center of the plate from Zach McAllister. He was just following him back. So his last swing was better. I think obviously the smart money is on him adjusting and figuring out a way. But I think it's just a matter of, is he hurt? No. Is he at full, complete strength? Probably not. I think that's where he's at right now.
John, your Fox Sports colleague, Ken Rosenthal, has an interesting item up as well about the Oakland Athletics. Now, we know that they've taken Jim Johnson, they've demoted him, or taken him, more properly put, they've taken him out of the closer's role. And Ken is suggesting, and we know how radical and how experimental Billy Beane can be, he's suggesting that there's a chance that the A's, it's not that they're going to go with a bullpen by committee. It's more like they're going to go with five or six closers in various situations, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really an avant-garde look on the modern bullpen, and obviously last night didn't work out too well. Luke Ferguson mm-hmm. blew a save, and then they lost. So I think that ultimately there is a lot of merit to this. It takes, I believe, a special manager, which I believe Bob Melvin is. I think he's one of the best in the game. And it takes a very willing and flexible bullpen to handle this. Because obviously, people that have come up in the game now over the last two decades have had this idea in their mind that there is a closer and there's a setup guy, maybe from the right side, there's maybe lefty setup guys, maybe a matchup guy, and that the bullpen is a place of very well-defined roles, so that way you can almost anticipate when you're in the bullpen, when the phone rings, who the manager's asking for. And now all of a sudden, that's not going to be the case for the Oakland A's. So you can manage it as long as obviously everybody's throwing well in their various roles, and they don't get a big ego about who's getting called in a certain situation. But that's where, if it were me, Jeff, I would, and I'm just trying to put myself mm-hmm. in the shoes of a relief pitcher, I'd sort of want to know when my time in the game was coming up,
yeah.
as opposed to having to be locked in and sort of just completely amped up from the sixth inning on because I wasn't sure when that was going to happen. That to me is the delicate balance here, and that's why it's a very emotionally stressful job, and you've got to have a lot of very steady people out there in the bullpen to handle that job, in a manager who's really got a good feel for that group, because the set roles in the bullpen have existed for a reason. And it's not just because of the closer. I think a lot of people get hung up on what the closer is doing, but it sort of lets the other five or six guys back there who have late inning roles know what to expect in a very stressful environment. So it's quite a gamble on human nature and on baseball custom. And obviously, last night it didn't work out. That's not to say it won't work tonight, but it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and if you're going to do that, the one thing you absolutely need to have is you've got to have guys with dominant stuff. I mean, you've got to have guys who can come in and get a strikeout at any point, essentially.
And yes, and guys that do not walk people.
Right.
Because all of a sudden, then, if you have guys that are, the guy that comes in and is not comfortable with the situation, issues a walk, and then if you have somebody else that has to come in and pick up his mess, and he's not used to coming in the middle of the inning, he's more used to coming in with a clean inning, that's a problem too. So, it's not just as simple as, well, I want to use my best reliever in the highest leverage situation possible. That sounds great on paper, and it probably has over time made some sense in an individual game. But when you look at the macro and you try to do it every single day, and you got guys jumbled all over the place, maybe one guy doesn't pitch for a week. It's hard to do it, and I give the A's credit for trying. And I know I'll be watching pretty closely to see if it works.
John, it was good of you to do this. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure, Jeff. Always excited this time of year, man. Got the playoffs on. I got one eye on the field, one eye on the hockey.
You like your Red Wings' chances against Boston?
Well, I think the Bruins will probably win in six games, but I think it's going to be a competitive series, and we'll see if Zetterberg materializes there at the end of the series.
Good stuff as always, John.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care. That is John Paul Morosi. He is the national baseball writer with Fox Sports, foxsports.com. Take a look at it. He and Ken Rosenthal have got an interesting piece. Rosenthal's piece on bullpen usage is really fascinating because it puts in context what the Oakland Athletics are doing. And as John Paul Morosi said, it did not work out last night. But it's an interesting idea and one that I wonder if a team, another American League team with a deep bullpen, with guys who have strikeout stuff, I wonder if it's a situation they might be looking at down the road. I wonder what team I could be talking about. The Toronto Raptors will start their playoff series against the Brooklyn Nets on Saturday afternoon. I've been saying all along that I respect the Nets, but I'm not necessarily fearful of a matchup against the Nets. I would rather play them than Charlotte. I know the whole issue with refereeing. I understand all that. The playoff whistle, as Matt Devlin explained to us yesterday, the playoff whistle is not always going to go in the Raptors' favor. But I'm going to say the Raps win this for five games. Maybe six, but I think they're going to win the series. Eric Smith is our Raptors radio analyst. He's a TV sideline reporter for Sportsnet's Raptors telecast, and he joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Eric, thanks so much for doing this. I'll ask you the same question I asked Masai Ujiri. Is there any emotional, anything the Raptors can take from the fact that it appears that the Brooklyn Nets kind of, now, they didn't shut down, but they looked at the potential playoff matchups and said, yeah, maybe Toronto's not that bad.
I think there, if there isn't, there should be. And I'll be honest, I did not hear your interview this morning. I knew he was coming on, but I've been running around doing a million other things after landing at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, being on daddy duty this morning. I spoke to Masai last night, though, and I did not send the interview even into the station to air or to play any clips because I knew he was coming on with you, so I didn't want to trump your interview this morning.
You're such a thoughtful person, Eric.
Hey,
thank you.
No problem. It'll air on Hoops tonight, so it'll be well after your show. But I asked him a similar question last night, and I actually transcribed the quote. I'm just pulling up my laptop.
Sure.
I'm trying to find exactly what he said. Can't find it right now, but I'm paraphrasing here, where he said, actually, here it is right here. Sometimes you start hoping for teams, and that's something that I've learned in the NBA, is when you start jockeying around and hoping that you get this guy or that team, it ultimately doesn't land that way. We came and we competed, and I think Dwayne's done a great job for this team. So, he kind of deflected the question a little bit, but basically I think he was implying that, hey, be careful what you wish for.
Mm-hmm.
Dwayne Casey said the same thing as well. So I talked to Steve Novak after the game, Jeff, and he actually did come out and all but word for word say, how do we not take it as a bit of a slap? It certainly seems like this is what they were trying to do, and we've got to use that as motivation. So he was maybe one or two players that actually did say and did admit that, yes, we'll take this as a shot. Most of the other guys are saying, hey, it doesn't matter. That's them. We're us. We got to be concerned with ourselves. But I think you've got to take it as a bit of a shot and use that as the, you know, whether it's chalkboard, bulletin board, whatever you want to call it. That's material, I think, that could be added motivation for Toronto.
Eric, I don't mind this matchup for the Raptors. I really don't. I get the edge and experience. I know that Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce are going to be a handful. There's going to be a lot of trash talking. There's a lot of big reputations, big personalities at work, but I don't mind this matchup. As a matter of fact, I'd rather play these guys in Charlotte, because I think Charlotte can do a little bit, can do some things athletically that these guys can't do.
You know, one of the other things that Masai said to me, Jeff, is he said, I don't think that they like us very much and we don't like them.
Mm.
So there's an underlying current there, I think, as well. In terms of what that brings to the table, of the dislike that perhaps each franchise or each organization has for one another right now, or the individual players. I think to your point, Dwayne Casey, sort of in talking in general, this was yesterday morning before the Raptors game itself, before they knew that they would play the Nets for certain. This was at the shoot-around yesterday morning. He kind of talked on the periphery about, you know, talking in general, the Nets are a little bit older. They play at a slower pace. That might be more suited to our game as opposed to the speed and athleticism of Washington, especially with John Wall, the issues that maybe Valanciunas has had with Gortat or even with Nene over the course of the season, the speed of Kemba Walker, the versatility and athleticism at the 4/5 of Al Jefferson, who's a tough cover for the personnel that the Raptors have. So he touched on a lot of those, talking, you know, just giving you little snippets of each team. And then when I talked to Masai last night after the game, when he knew that they'd be playing the Nets, he sort of made similar comments in regards to, hey, you know, the Washington and Charlotte are pretty athletic. I don't know if that would have been the ultimate best matchup for us. Maybe this is the better head-to-head for us based on style of play and the fact maybe we can be the young athletic club that's trying to dictate the pace against an older team, a slower team, albeit an experienced team, a championship experienced team, but maybe we can be the ones that can be the, you know, the brash young team that catches the older squad by surprise.
Eric Smith joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Eric, you've been around this basketball team all year. You've been around basketball in this city for a long time. Do you think this is the most likable Raptors team that Toronto's had? And do you think Toronto's really going to embrace this team? Like, I'll be interested in seeing what Maple Leaf Square is like, because I think in a lot of ways, Eric, that's kind of become, I mean, we know there are going to be people in the stands and we know they're going to be noisy, but I think in a lot of ways, Maple Leaf Square has kind of become the focal point in this city. It's how you gauge just how crazy people are about a team, I guess, is the way I'm trying to put it. Is Toronto ready to embrace this team?
I think they are. I think a lot of people already have, in terms of, you know, kind of keeping that one eye on what's happening with that Raptor team over there. What's going on here? And then people start, you know, I think I'm going to go check out a game. And, you know, now I'm going to make sure I watch for the highlights. I think that's already started to happen. I agree with you on one hand, Jeff, about Maple Leaf Square. On the other hand, I don't know that it will be the draw that it was for the Leafs. I have no doubt there's going to be people there and a lot of people there. I just don't know if it'll be, you know, shoulder to shoulder. You literally can't move like it was for the Maple Leafs last year and even the year before that. I hope I'd love to be proven wrong. I'd love to see it absolutely crammed in there and you can't get anybody in there even with a shoehorn. I just think it could take maybe a couple of games to sort of get that vibe going. For game one, I think the city will be hyped. I think it would have been an even bigger deal, and perhaps Maple Leaf Square would have been potentially even more jammed had it been an evening game, and it's an event at night. You can maybe have a few pops, and you head down to the square, and you kind of get in on the party, and then you're going to go out afterwards. At 12:30 on a Saturday afternoon, I'm not sure how many people are going to be jacked up, even those with families as well, to walk down to watch the big TV. But I hope ultimately that it turns into a big party. And I think that even if folks aren't there, I would anticipate a spike in, you know, television numbers and radio numbers and everything else. And, you know, you can speak to it even better than I can, but the coverage from the newspaper suddenly going from one or two writers to five or six from each paper showing up. I mean, I think the attention's going to be there. And on top of that, with the Knicks out of the playoffs, and the Nets in, you're going to be getting Brooklyn writers, you're going to be getting New York writers, the Knick writers, the Net writers. The profile on the Raptors right now on NBA TV as well, on ESPN, and the profile facing a top team like Brooklyn, I think is just going to put Toronto in the focus that much more, not just in the city, not just in this country, but stateside as well.
Eric, it was good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. You're going to have a hectic few weeks ahead of you, and I'm sure you'll love every second of it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Take care. That is Eric Smith. He is our Raptors radio analyst and TV sideline reporter on Sportsnet Raptors telecast. Again, the Raptors and Brooklyn Nets, they will get their playoff series going Saturday afternoon at the Air Canada Center. Tim Capstra is the Brooklyn Nets radio analyst, and he joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Tim, thanks so much for doing this.
No problem, Jeff.
So the talking point here, we talked to Masai Ujiri, we talked to Eric Smith about it, talked to Raptors players. The talking point here, the Raptors seem to think that the Nets tanked or the Nets played out the season with an eye toward meeting the Raptors in the first round. Now, depending on the player you talk to, some of the Raptors players just kind of roll their eyes at it and essentially say, well, yeah, you know, probably a lot of other teams would have done the same thing. Some of the Raptors players take a little bit of offense to it. How do you approach this? And is there a danger kind of flirting with the basketball gods here by doing that? Or does it simply come down to the fact that Jason Kidd's got an older team and he's got to rest guys?
Yeah, come on. Are you serious? That is not true. There's no truth to that. Jason Kidd's got older players. Jason Kidd knows better than anybody what it takes to be prepared for the playoffs being an older player or an injured player. Mm-hmm. He was a guy just last year for the Knicks who was totally burned out during the regular season and had absolutely nothing for the playoffs. He is giving guys that were injured breaks or spacing out a little bit of time for a couple of guys. But to say that the Nets were tanking to play the Raptors is not correct at all. They're just he knew it was going to be the Bulls or the Raptors, and they weren't going to be have home court, so it didn't matter to him. That's why he rested players.
The matchup against the Raptors, I mean, it's a classic matchup, a team with a lot of playoff experience against a team that hasn't been to the playoffs, a team that doesn't have a great deal. Yeah, of playoff experience, and what playoff experience it has, frankly, is largely on the bench. How much of a difference, though, do you think can coaching make here? You've got a guy who's a young coach, still kind of making his way. As a matter of fact, when the Nets were in Toronto earlier this year, there was some concern as to whether or not Jason would be able to get this job done. You've got him against a guy who's a veteran defensive specialist who's won a championship with another team. Is there a coaching edge here?
I don't think so. I think, you got 82 games of what you've been doing. I don't think either coach necessarily changes anything when the playoffs come. I think that there could be adjustments made. I don't think anything is that big of a deal. I don't know. I mean, maybe Jason Kidd has just impressed me so much with his just feel for the game, as has Dwayne Casey, that I don't know that I could go with mm-hmm. any kind of edge either way. It's hard to say. I think players win the games, and I don't think there's that many surprises once it comes playoff time.
When did Jason hit his stride as a coach this year? Was there a game, a turning point, a time where, I'm not saying that you guys necessarily thought he wasn't going to be successful, but was there a point in time where, you know, he hit his stride as a head coach?
Yeah, I think when the new year changed and he had to make an adjustment and said, listen, I think that the lineup that we have on the floor has to be adjusted. And he brought on January 1st, put Sean Livingston at the point guard position and moved Paul Pierce to the four position. The other thing it did, though, was take Deron Williams oftentimes off the ball. He became a two. Joe Johnson became a small forward. The Nets went with a different type of lineup that way, and I think that decision to start 2014 down in Oklahoma City, and then the Nets were down 16 points in the second half, came back, won the game on a Joe Johnson buzzer beater. That was the game that kind of turned things for the Nets. It was a new year. It was a new team. They kind of wanted to forget about everything, how poorly everything had gone, and because of that, that success they had in that game, it really got them going. I think they won, I forget how many they won in a row, 9, 10 in a row.
Mm-hmm.
They felt better about themselves. It was that Paul Pierce at that power forward position that you think is kind of small ball, but then when you put a 6'7" Sean Livingston on the floor at the point guard position, kind of levels it out. And it's interesting. The Nets might not have a classic power forward on the floor, but they, because of their length at other positions, make up for that.
Tim, was good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. That is Tim Capstraw. He's the Brooklyn Nets radio analyst. And I don't think he liked that question about the Nets tanking. Which, look, I mean, that's one of the storylines. You know that's going to be spun going into the playoffs. That's absolutely going to be one of the spins on this series. You know, the whole beware what you hope for scenario with the Brooklyn Nets and the Toronto Raptors. But it has to be said, too, that Jason Kidd has an older team, and he's entirely within his right. There are people out there who are saying, well, didn't what the Nets do sort of violate the integrity of the NBA? No, you know what Jason Kidd did? We can sit here and say that deep down the Nets are not, they're not upset having to face the Raptors. But Jason Kidd, I'm sure, a large part of this process, too, is I got to rest some of these guys. I got to give some of these older guys some time off because I'm going to require big minutes out of them, especially guys like Garnett and Pierce. So I think you have to be careful before you go entirely towards that direction of saying the Nets tank to play the Raptors. Although having said that, I mean, if you're the Brooklyn Nets and you take a look at your team and you say, what is our strength? What is our undeniable strength? It's experience. It's the understanding of playoff basketball. It is the reputation of some of the individual players. And if you take that strength and say, how can we maximize its effectiveness in the playoffs? Who would our opponent be that would allow us to maximize that effectiveness in the playoffs? Clearly, by virtue of their lack of experience, the Toronto Raptors would have to be, along with the Washington Wizards, the number one choice if you're the Brooklyn Nets. It is a storyline that, as I said, will be much discussed going into the playoffs. Game one, Saturday at the Air Canada Center. The Stanley Cup playoffs got underway last night. Montreal, Pittsburgh winners in overtime. Anaheim beating Dallas. At some point, one would presume that the goaltenders would wake up. It was not. Overtime hockey is usually really good and really compelling. I thought a couple of these games last night were just not very good hockey. And the team that made the fewest big mistakes won, which I know you're saying, Jeff, that's the way it usually happens. I didn't think this was a great opening night of playoff hockey, or overtime games aside. Rick Natras is co-host of our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. He's going to join us. We're going to recap the first night of Stanley Cup playoffs, which I said it was like watching the Leafs. I mean, it was nothing but turnovers, two-on-ones, lousy defensive play, lousy zone coverage. Really, it was like watching the entire Leafs season right in front of you and a couple of games spread over a couple of channels. We'll talk to Rick Natras about that when the Jeff Blair Show continues right up the Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Buffalo soldier, dreadlock rasta. It was a Buffalo soldier in the heart of America. Stolen from Africa.
It's fitting music for this time of the year. Baseball Central with Kevin Barker is just around the corner. John Gibbons The manager of your Toronto Blue Jays will join us. Joe Siddall will also join us from Tarjay Field. And if you follow Joe Sitter on Twiddle, if you follow Joe Siddall on Twitter, you get a chance to take a look at the pictures he and Barry Davis are sending out of the ballpark. And wow, it is it does not look good. You know, of course, that yesterday's game was snowed out. They are going to try to play a doubleheader today, but they got some work to do to get the field ready. So we'll touch base with Joe Siddall and see how things are progressing at Target Field. And that is, I think you checked, Travis McKenzie, my producer, you checked, that's the Jays' only trip into Minnesota this year, right? So they'll wait around till the bitter end to try to get at least one of those games in. And again, we are scheduled to have both ends of the doubleheader on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. First pitch is, I believe, around 1 o'clock. So the NHL playoffs started last night, and Montreal and Pittsburgh won in overtime, and Anaheim took an early lead against Dallas and held on to win. I got to tell you, I love overtime playoff hockey. I much prefer overtime playoff hockey to the 5-minute overtime in the regular season. But Rick Natras, the co-host of our Leafs Nation pre and post game, joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. And Rick, I got to tell you, I didn't think it was classic hockey last night.
Well, it was classic run and gun. I think, you know, transition turnovers. You know, certainly the Montreal game. I thought Montreal played, you know, a very good game. I didn't think Carey Price was that good, to be honest with you. I thought Tampa was, you know, trying to find things. Montreal clogged up the middle pretty good in the neutral zone, and they, you know, when there was turnovers, they responded and they took advantage of it. But, again, Tampa, I think, was just a little, you know, they had 8 guys first time in the National Hockey League playoffs, so you saw a little jitters maybe trying to force things and keep things out of the middle would probably be your best bet. But, again, I thought Montreal played a really good road game, and I thought Tampa had an opportunity to steal a game they didn't deserve to win.
At times, it looked to me like we were watching the Maple Leafs. I mean, I kept looking for Dion Phaneuf to be out in the ice or Tim Gleason. It just, again, I'm being a little facetious here.
No, I heard you before I came on, right? So I was listening to your show to see what kind of mood you're in, and I was laughing to my wife. I said, "Here he goes." But you know, it was, and it opens up. It's funny, Jeff, and this is, you either have you're too tense and you're watching, or you're overplaying things, and there's that fine line in between that you have to. We see the goal by Weiss, you know, in overtime for Montreal to win, where, you know, Tampa started getting their game back. That overtime, I thought, was probably their best period, or their best hockey of the game. But then again, they get over aggressive. The one guy that's off to the side of the net doesn't pick up Weiss, and, you know, off the other post, and you're sort of puck eyes. And we saw a couple of the Tampa Bay players have that, rather than, you know, either collapsing and taking that option away and giving them the less, less percentage-wise shooting one. But, again, it happens. And I think, you know, emotions are a funny thing, and I think Daniel Breer said it. It's a game where even if things aren't going your way, and we could talk about the Leafs, you have to stick to the plan. And I think for Montreal, they did that better than Tampa.
One of the things I really liked out of Montreal, Thomas Vanek, a guy that I mean, to me, well, yeah, the line is tremendous, but to me, this may come down to Thomas Vanek having to outplay Steven Stamkos.
Yeah, you look at the goal, I mean, just, you know, I mean, the goal he scored by beating, you know, getting in behind the defenseman and going hard to the net, some of the plays he was doing, you see the strategy by Montreal, shoot from everywhere. You know, the Tampa Bay goaltender has a history of letting in some soft goals off to the side. So, I mean, that line was very good. The fourth line, Briere's line, you know, that ended up getting the winner in overtime was very good. I thought Montreal, you know, certainly had more guys that showed up. I still think PK's got to do a better job at, you know, it's funny how that came out, that he needs to find, make simple plays. I think if you look at the top defensemen in the National Hockey League, they don't always try to make the pretty play, and I think that's where PK's game's got to mature a little bit. But Certainly Markov was good. Georges was really good. I thought, you know, Tampa, Stamkos, again, his game's coming around now that, you know, he's played a little bit more and coming back from that leg injury. So I think Tampa's got a better game in their, you know, in their pocket in regards to structure because Cooper is, you know, very structured guy. He's had a lot of success wherever he's gone, and it's because of team structure. And I think Montreal, if they can keep four lines going the way they did last night, they're going to have a lot of a good opportunity to be successful.
Rick Natras joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Rick, can Columbus beat Pittsburgh playing the way they played them last night?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, Columbus, if they get hard, a good forecheck, and make sure you're physical, and if you don't give those forwards the puck, we've seen what Pittsburgh does in its own end, and it's not very good. And we can always blame that on Fleury. But in my eyes, the Pittsburgh's never been a really, really good team in their own end. That's one of the reasons they got Scuderi, you know, that kind of thing. So the forecheck is hugely important for Columbus. And again, you know, with a couple of the Ryan Johansson and then Jake Johnson, I mean, these guys are... Hey, they're dominant players, and they were dominant last night. But I think if the physicality that Columbus has to do, and certainly off the forecheck, will really dictate if they're going to have success or not.
Speaking of physicality, Philadelphia, the Rangers tonight, Chicago, St. Louis, L.A., and San Jose. This is this is a night for men, isn't it? This really is.
This is, you know, and it's scary because we're going to see some good teams get knocked out, you know, St. Louis, Chicago, and then you got the San Jose, L.A. is going to be, you know, get a nap, everybody, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is a game, and this is a series that is just, you know, goes back to last year, too, with L.A. and St. Louis. You look at that one, that was... You know, sometimes there's the Stanley Cup final before the Stanley Cup final gets there. And it's just in the fact that maybe it's not the best two teams, but it's the best teams at that time playing the best style of playoff hockey.
And they went right at each other.
It was hard. It was hard, and it's, man. You know, Randy Carlyle talks about when they went down to California and won the 2 out of 3. He talked about it's a big boys game. This is a man's game. And this is what we talk about in what needs to be played, you know, on a consistent basis, or as consistent as you can be because of the physicality so high. And these guys, especially San Jose, L.A., it's going to be, you know, in L.A., this is how they win. They don't score a lot of goals, but they're going to punish you, and it's usually the last man standing. And I hate to compare it as a war, but it's as close as a war you can get in hockey.
Rick, it was good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All righty, that is Rick Natras, co-host of Our Leafs Nation pre- and post-game. Again, the games tonight, Philly and the Rangers. Chicago and St. Louis and L.A. and San Jose, those are both the Hockey Night in Canada games. Minnesota plays the Colorado Avalanche. And, yeah, L.A. and Rick Natras is right. You're best advised to maybe grab a nap ahead of LA and San Jose, because that is going to be terrific. That's just such a compelling first round. It's a compelling matchup. There's just enough dislike between those two teams. Honestly, between Philadelphia and the Rangers, Chicago and St. Louis, and LA and San Jose, this to me is the night the playoffs start. Last night was just kind of the appetizer. And as I said, I didn't find it a very appetizing appetizer. It wasn't, to me, classic playoff hockey. Tonight we're going to get the classic playoff hockey. And it really is. I just keep looking at those matchups in the West. I know everybody says this, but it really is remarkable when you look at those matchups in the West, the quality of team or the quality of teams that are going to go home in that series. I mean, you're going to lose either St. Louis or Chicago or San Jose and LA in the first round. I mean, you're losing teams that could very easily win the Eastern Conference in the first round. So, again, that is what is on tap tonight. As we said, we hope to have baseball today. We have a double header scheduled. Last night's game was snowed out in Minnesota. It's not snowing today, but the field is in not great shape. We do have baseball scheduled, a day-night doubleheader. John Gibbons, the manager of the Blue Jays, is going to join us in Baseball Central in a few minutes. We'll get an update from him as to the status of the game, the status of Adam Lind's back, who might go down with Jose Reyes due to come back for the Blue Jays, and what the Blue Jays expect out of R.A. Dickey today. Baseball Central with Kevin Barker, and yours truly is next. John Gibbons and Joe Siddall will join us. Lots of baseball talk ahead. Right up to Hockey Central. Stay tuned, everybody.